1954, Johansson discovered the fossil remains of a 3-million-year-old woman that he named Lucy, and she remains the oldest human ancestor that we have found so far. The debate over human evolution and Lucy's place in it made Johansson famous and also brought him into conflict with one of anthropology's most prominent families, the Leakeys. It was ironic then that when Johansson returned to Africa after an absence of many years, he went to look for new fossils in Olduvai Gorge, which was a site made famous by the Leakeys. There he found parts of a skeleton that helped to establish the line of descent that he argues runs from Lucy to us. He has written a book about his experiences in paleoanthropology, about his recent finds, but also about Lucy and about his career generally. The title of that book is Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor. His co-author on this book is James Shreve. He is the author of another book, Nature, the Other Earthlings, a companion to the PBS television series. He's a science writer that makes his home in Massachusetts. As we talk this morning with Donald Johansson, you're welcome to call in if you have questions. The telephone number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. It is different from that first number, and you may use that number wherever you are if you're outside of the immediate area. The toll-free line is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Dr. Johansson, hello.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you. Thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
What I would like to do first is to try to get some understanding of the significance of Lucy. And perhaps you could talk a little bit about what the thinking was as far as the family, the human family tree goes, what the thinking was before you found Lucy. And then we could talk about where she fits in.
Well, in 1974, when I was conducting some major expeditions in northeastern Ethiopia, in an area called the Afar Triangle, I was beginning to explore a series of geological deposits that are dated between 3 and 4 million years in age. And at that time, the paleontological record for our human ancestry was very sparse during that period of time, in the sense that you could basically fit all the fossils that had ever been found that had been dated to, say, 3 to 4 million years in the palm of your hand. And we really didn't know what sort of a hominid ancestor we would find from this time period, and we were particularly interested in knowing not only the anatomical characteristics of that specimen or of that species, but also the sort of pace of hominid evolution and the sequence of changes that our ancestors went through. So when Lucy was found, and she's dated at about 3.2 million years, she really opened up a rather major new vista for us in terms of understanding hominid origins, because she did possess that cardinal feature of what it means to be placed in the human family or in hominids, as opposed to the ape family, in that she was walking upright. She was walking bipedally. She had abandoned four-legged locomotion and acquired that one single characteristic that distinguishes us from all other primates like monkeys and apes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But what was astonishing was how primitive she was from the neck up. She had a very tiny brain, a brain that was only about one-fourth the size of a modern human brain, a very projecting face, muscle markings, and many anatomical details of the teeth and jaws that were highly reminiscent of an ape ancestry. And what we did, my colleagues and I, particularly Tim White, a colleague here at the University of California at Berkeley, the two of us published a revised family tree, which of course is one of our goals to try to relate all of these fossils to one another, and we placed Lucy at the trunk of that tree, and we postulated in 1979 that Lucy would in fact be the common ancestor for all later branches of human evolution, including that branch which ultimately led to the larger-brained hominids, like Homo habilis, the first toolmaker, at about 2 million years, Homo erectus at about 1.5 million years, and ultimately the emergence of ourselves, Homo sapiens, about 150,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to get people confused here, but I do want them to understand some of this terminology if they're not familiar with it already. All all animals have these two Latin names that people may be familiar with. We human beings now are Homo sapiens. And there is the first one is the genus name and the other one is the species name. So what we had previous to Lucy was we had a number of individuals. We had some individuals that belonged in the genus Australopithecus, and we had some individuals that belonged in the genus Homo. And the question at that point was, you know, we had a fair idea when these individuals all lived, but the question was, how were all these related? And were, in fact, we talking about two separate lines, that is the Australopithecus, of which Lucy is a representative, and the Homos, were they somehow two parallel lines, or were they, in fact, related? And apparently where the controversy came up with Lucy is your argument that in fact Lucy was the common ancestor of all of the later examples of both of these that we had, and that there were some people in the field, and I guess the Leakeys were among them, who were saying, well, no, they didn't think that was true, that the two lines were somehow more separate, and that there may have been a common ancestor, but that would have been much further back in time than Lucy.
That's exactly right. I think that the major controversy which has surrounded this debate that Richard and I have had basically is a result of a family view of human origins. The late Louis Leakey, who in fact you may or may not know, did come to Champaign-Urbana in the early 1960s and spend a whole semester teaching. And when I was an undergraduate student, I took a course from him when I was in Urbana. But Lewis subscribed to a view that he had developed early on in his career, which was that the line of true man, or Homo, the large brain form, went back into the fossil record millions of years beyond the appearance of Australopithecus, and that Australopithecus was simply an ape man that was an interesting evolutionary experiment, but it was a parallel line, and it was in no way to be considered an ancestor to these larger brain forms. So that when I came along with my colleagues in the late 1970s and postulated that Australopithecus, we gave her the name Afarensis as a species name after the Afar Triangle in Ethiopia, that Afarensis was the common ancestor to the two branches, that's really where we've had the focus of our debate. And I must say that now, it's 10 years later since we postulated this in the journal Science, and I would say that virtually every anthropologist, with the exception of Richard Leakey, does use Afarensis as the trunk of the tree. The particular geometry of the tree subsequent to Afarensis, let's say between 2 and 3 million years, is still a matter of debate, and it depends on to whom you're speaking, because everybody draws a slightly different version of the tree. But what is common to all of the trees is that Australopithecus, and in this case, Australopithecus afarensis, is the common ancestor to all later branches. And Richard, I think, is probably the only exception to this right now. Mm.
Well, we're talking this morning with Donald Johanson. He's the founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins in Berkeley, California. He's a paleoanthropologist, and we're talking with him about some of the finds that he's made in his career, and the story of them is recorded in his recent book written with James Shreve. The title of the book is Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor. We're here open to questions, if you like. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, your more recent finds seem to reinforce this view that, in fact, Lucy, Australopithecus afarensis, is in fact the common ancestor of the two lines, and is a true ancestor of the genus Homo, because what the new find seems to be a transitional stage in between Lucy and the first of the true men, the Homo erectus. Okay, yeah, good. I get a little confused with all these various individuals myself. Can you talk a little bit more about how the partial skeleton that you found fits in with what we had before?
Sure, certainly. In 1964, Louis Leakey, along with Philip Tobias and John Napier, published an article in the international journal Nature based on a number of specimens which had been found at Olduvai Gorge that exhibited substantial brain enlargement. As I said, Australopithecus, in the case of Lucy, we might look at her as having a brain about a quarter the size of our brains. Homo habilis, which they announced in 1964, had a substantially enlarged brain that was close to half the size of a modern human brain, not quite. Now, they postulated that this was the creature responsible for the stone tools at Olduvai. They named it Homo habilis, the handyman. And I think there has been a vision over the last, 20 or so years that Homo habilis was probably fairly modern-looking in terms of its anatomy. Yet when we found in 1986 this partial skeleton, it certainly is nowhere as complete as the Lucy skeleton was. But what was remarkable about the partial skeleton from Olduvai Gorge in northern Tanzania, which is about 1.5 million years later after Lucy, 1.5 million years after the occurrence of Lucy, about 1.8 million years ago, was the fact that there were striking similarities, particularly in the postcranial skeleton, that is to say, below the neck, that Homo habilis was still a fairly small creature, only about 3.5 feet tall, this was probably a female, and still possessed, interestingly, relatively long arms, which means that the length of, say, the humerus, the upper arm bone, is about 85% the length of the thigh bone. In modern humans, our arm is only about 70% the length of our lower limbs. And it does appear now that this was a transitional form. It appears that natural selection focused in the interim period on changes in the teeth and jaws and changes in brain size. That intelligence was something that was of a particularly high premium, and this is, of course, reflected in the enlarged brain case. But the postcranial skeleton shows interesting links with Lucy, because Lucy's child, as we've called her, the Homo habilis partial skeleton from Olduvai, still possesses relatively long arms. And in a way, it does reinforce the link between afarensis and early Homo habilis, because there have been some suggestions that Australopithecus was too primitive or too odd or specialized to be an ancestor to later Homo. But I think this does provide a very interesting evolutionary link because of the anatomical similarities.
Mm-hmm. Before your find at Olduvai, this partial skeleton that we're calling Lucy's child, were there skeletal remains of Homo habilis? Did we have that material?
Well, we had fragmentary parts. One of the most interesting aspects of these two discoveries that our teams have made, both Lucy and Lucy's child, is that we do have associated parts of skeletons. All right. Now, in the case of Homo habilis prior to this, we might have had a piece of arm bone, okay, or we had some wonderful femurs. We had isolated bones, but we didn't have associated bones from the same skeleton. So while you could say something about the particular anatomy of that bone, you couldn't say anything about the relationships between, let's say, upper and lower limb.
Okay. I have a caller here we'd like to bring into our conversation. Anyone who is listening is welcome to call in with questions. The local number here is 333-WILL or 9455. It's the same either way. And the toll-free line, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller on our line number one. Hello.
Hello. The caller here is Chingalva. I'm a graduate student from India, and I just have two short questions for you. The first one is, you said Lucy is about 3 million years old. Now, what I want to know is, what's the margin of error? I mean, how many years either way can you, allow for error?
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of Lucy, we're probably looking at something like about 100,000 years one way or the other. But what is significant is that the species Australopithecus afarensis has been dated back as far as 4 million years, and it appears to have survived for a period of about 1 million years. The very earliest material that's dated at 4 million years as I recall, has a error of plus or minus something like 50,000 years. So that, and in, at this time period, that's a relatively small error and really doesn't figure in substantially into our family tree.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that's a pretty small error. My other question was, everyone talks of Lucy's descendants, but who's Lucy's direct ancestor, if there is any?
Wonderful question. One of the most intriguing questions that anthropologists are thinking about at the moment, because you may or may not know that for many years, people suspected that there were fossils from Pakistan and India, which are known as Ramapithecus, that may have been, in fact, an early hominid. The problem is we only have teeth and jaws of these creatures, and we're unable to tell how they locomoted, whether they were bipedal or quadrupedal. More recent discoveries in Pakistan of Ramapithecus dated at about 7 million years suggest that at least part of them were ancestors for later orangutans. Now, we do have a gap in the fossil record. We have good fossils back to about 4 million, and then in Africa we don't have fossils back until about 10 or 11 million years, which means we have about a 6 million year gap between the fossil apes of Africa and the emergence of the earliest humans. So at the moment it's still a question mark. We are unable to precisely identify the ancestor who was an antecedent to Lucy.
Oh, I see. So it looks as though the most important thing right now is who's Lucy's ancestor, right? Because that's more like the missing link rather than Lucy and her descendants.
That's right. Lucy is very close to that because she does have a very primitive ape-like skull and an upright bipedal body. But there undoubtedly was something that came before that that was even more primitive. What is intriguing to think about is that as we go back in time and we get closer and closer to the common ancestor for contemporary African apes like the chimpanzee and the gorilla and contemporary humans, or let's say the common ancestor for both of those lines, it will look more and more and more ape-like. And it is my prediction that if we find only teeth and jaws, which, of course, are the things that preserve the best in the fossil record, we will not be able to distinguish apes from hominids. And what we will have to find is the postcranial bones that will indicate to us whether they were upright bipeds or were still quadrupeds.
Oh, I see. Thank you very much, Dr.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Bye-bye.
Let me ask you just quickly before we go on to another caller. Do you think that if we look long enough, eventually we will have a complete fossil record, or do you think that there will always be some gaps?
Well, I think that the fossil record is always going to be a matter of debate because the geological processes on this planet have never been kind enough to us to preserve as complete and densely populated a record as we would like to have. However, I must say that with each discovery we make, we do get a better, a sharper image, a more complete image of what hominid evolution was about. But I think that there's always going to be problems of debate with particular specimens and particular periods of time. And it's, of course, one of the things that keeps anthropologists in business, getting out there and trying to complete and fill in the record more and more.
Yeah. Okay, here's another caller, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Dr. Johansson, I had some students visit me who listened to your lecture here at Illinois on Lucy. You were on campus. And I just wanted to thank you and tell you that I know at least 10 young people now who are interested in your field from the books you've written, you and Stephen Gould and Carl Sagan, of bringing science to the public. And it's easy to keep academic knowledge on a campus. And I'm deeply grateful. My grandson now wants to be an anthropologist because it's exciting, and we've given him your books. But I want to thank you very much for...
You're very welcome. I really feel that as a scientist involved in a particular field of inquiry that is of interest to so many people. And I've talked to Carl Sagan about this myself, and in fact, Steve Gould and I were on a radio program here in San Francisco a couple of weeks ago. We share the view that this knowledge should be made available to anyone and everyone who is interested. And I think that it's a responsibility that we have to bring it to them in the popular media, not only through telephone interviews like this or television appearances, public lectures, and publishing books, but in other ways also. It is really a responsibility that we have to make this information available to anyone and everyone who is interested in it.
Well, thank you again. And I have a question. At what time can you, or is there a time in history that you can pick up on genetic markers? Is there enough organic material in a bone or something that you can begin then to trace migrations through genetic markers? Or is that a future field? Is it being used at all now?
Well, that's a wonderful question. I think that in the sense of the fossils that I deal with in Africa, the only genetic markers that we would see, of course, would be expressed in the anatomy. If there was a peculiarity in the teeth or in the shape of a jaw or whatever, it would be an expression of the genetic marker that we might find in other populations and might be able to use that to trace similarities between very distant populations of early hominids. However, the record, unfortunately, isn't complete enough to allow us to do that back then. More recently, of course, many colleagues have looked at migrations of Asians into the New World in terms of Eskimo and Indian populations, and Christy Turner at the University of Arizona has a number of genetic markers that he sees in the teeth that he can trace back to Siberia and the Soviet Union. Now, in terms of looking at the genetic material itself, this is an area which is still in its infancy, I think. We do not have DNA preserved in these very ancient fossils. There is, of course, DNA preserved in the mummies of Egypt, for example, and people are beginning to map that DNA in order to understand the presence or absence of particular mutations or markers or whatever. And I suspect that as we begin to look at more recent populations, we will be able to pick up more and more information from DNA.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. We'll go on to another caller in a moment and, of course, talk some more with Dr. Donald Johansson. He is with us here. We'll be with us for about another 20-25 minutes. This morning on Focus, we're speaking with Donald Johansson. He's the founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins in Berkeley, California. He is the co-author of the book Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor. He is the discoverer of Lucy, which still remains the oldest human ancestor we have yet found. And the book is in part about that, but also about the discovery of skeletal remains of another individual, an individual that he calls Lucy's Child, that again helps to establish this line of descent from Lucy to us. And if you have questions for us, so we'd be happy to take them, locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here on our toll-free line, and we'll talk with them next. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
A comment and then a question, if I might. Mm-hmm. First of all, I just truly applaud all the work being done in looking at origins of all life in any form, whether it be on the Earth itself or in the whole universe. And being, I guess you'd call me, a liberal mainline Protestant, I do not understand why there is still this conflict between religion and science, especially as it relates to the creation scientists. I cannot believe that they have read all of the literature that's out there and still maintain their position. And I guess I'd like to have the visitor comment on that.
Well, you certainly made more of a comment than a question. I could enlarge on it a little bit, I suppose, in the sense that I do think that there really is no conflict whatsoever between religion and science. I think that they're two quite distinct issues and two distinct ways of looking at the world around us. religion, of course, one's own religion is based on one's own personal belief, and that's not something that science should tamper with. We don't ask somebody to prove their belief in a particular deity or whatever. There's no scientific proof for the fact that Jesus was the Son of God. We accept that if we are a Protestant or a Catholic. On the other hand, we don't ask religious questions of science. We don't ask whether or not, for example, gravity is moral. Gravity is a fact. It is an observable law, in fact. And what I think has happened is there is a group of scientists out here in California, in Southern California, at the Institute for Creation Research, who have come together and decided that they want to have equal time in the schools for not religion, they say, and not spiritual interpretations, but for what they call scientific creationism. And in fact, if you dissect that phrase, it's really, as a word that's become popular these days, an oxymoron, because science can't be creationist and creationism can't be scientific. And what they are trying to do, unfortunately, I think, is really to debase our educational system. Rather than enlightening our students with scientific knowledge, the scientific method, a method of objective inquiry, and so on, they're confusing students by putting these two phrases together. And in fact, it wasn't long ago that I saw an application form for the Institute of Creation Research. And when you apply for membership, you have to sign an affidavit that you believe in the Great Flood, that you believe that Jesus was the Son of God, that the Bible essentially is literal truth. And as you well know, as a scientist, if you go into any field of inquiry with preconceived notions, it's certainly not being very scientific. And I find it very unfortunate that the scientific creationists have been politically very powerful and have lobbied around the country. But I do find it very refreshing that our Supreme Court has withheld the decision to keep church and state separate. And in a major decision 2 years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that scientific creationism really is a cover-up for a particular religious point of view that people are trying to enforce on our educational system.
I agree with everything you've said, and I guess it just makes me wonder how school systems can even give credence or give time to these people that want to have their view even considered in textbooks. I just think that's bad education, and I'm really disappointed that educational systems would even give them the time of day.
Well, I agree, and you know, for someone like myself who works in East Africa, I've worked in East Africa since 1970, these are third world countries who look up to the United States for leadership and guidance and direction, and I remember someone saying, this is unbelievable that a country that has put a man on the moon, a rocket ship that has recently left our solar system, that there's a substantial number of people in this country who are willing to overlook all of these scientific achievements, accept the literalness of the Bible, and say that the world was created in 7 days at 4004 B.C. on an October Sunday morning.
Is that daylight saving or Eastern Standard?
Yes. I mean, it's really extraordinary. But thank you for calling.
Yes,
I appreciate the call. Thank you. I'd like to, Professor Johansson, have you talk a little bit about what is involved in finding the specimens that you have found. And I'm very curious about whether, you know, for example, if I was to go walking along Olduvai Gorge, would I spot these things? Do you have to have a trained eye? Are they exposed? Are they partially exposed? And what does the territory look like? And what do you see as you walk along looking for fossils?
Well, Olduvai Gorge and many of these sites, the site where Lucy was found up in Ethiopia, are very much like the eroded badlands of the Dakotas in North America. And all of us who live in cities, in urban communities, have our eyes focused on very different sorts of things. When we're driving along, we're looking for large objects like cars or stoplights or intersections or pedestrians or whatever. And I would say that if you had the opportunity to come to the field with me, you'd probably have an experience not unlike the one I had when I first went to Africa in 1970, when it took me several weeks before I began to be able to differentiate the fossils from their background on the soil. These are fossils that have eroded out of deposits that are lying on the surface of the ground and have a different shape, a different quality, a different color to them. And there is a particular method of looking. There is a way that you train your mind to recognize shapes and colors and nuances of changes in contrast that allow you to recognize these fossils. And one can be trained to do this very well. For example, an experiment was done a number of years ago in East Africa when Richard Leakey's team kept finding teeth and jaws. And I remember I was in Nairobi at about this time, and someone said, you know, isn't it curious that all of these hominids are found, yet apparently they didn't have any arms and legs? How come nobody's found any arms and legs? Because the people who were looking for these fossils were trained to look for teeth, to look for skull parts, and to look for jaws. Hmm. So what we did in Nairobi was they were taken to the National Museum, and they were given, I think, a couple of weeks looking at human skeletons and told that this is a thigh bone, and this is a tibia, which is a shin bone, this is an arm bone, this is a vertebra, and so forth. And then they were sent back out into the field to search similar areas or the same areas, and lo and behold, they came back with the arms and legs of these early hominids. So there is a certain amount of training, and there is also, I think, some people are very good at it, others are not so good at it.
Hmm. Not to take anything away from you as a scientist or any of your colleagues, but I also wonder, is there some element of luck involved?
Well, I think that, you know, luck is a very peculiar term because it often evokes the image that, well, you know, if he was simply lucky, and that was the only reason he found it. I think it's a combination of, you know, opportunity and circumstance and training that all go together. When I was an undergraduate in Urbana, I worked very hard to train myself in archaeological method and archaeological technique by participating in field schools and excavating in the Southwest with some of my professors from the University of Illinois. And I got myself trained in the methodology. And I was particularly passionate about the field. This is really what I wanted to do, and I directed all of my energies in that direction. Now, working where I worked in northeastern Ethiopia, it was not luck that I was there. I had met a geologist who had worked there and who expressed to me the fact that there were fossils all over these deposits, showed me photographs, and I went out and systematically organized a survey team to walk the landscape in a regular fashion, just like gridding off an archaeological site. And we systematically worked through the site. So that, there is an element of luck involved in the sense that if you walked 10 feet over in another direction, you might have missed that specimen, but if you came back the next day, you might have found it.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's really, I think, a combination of really being trained to do a job, doing it with a tremendous amount of dedication, and really going out there and putting all of those elements together.
We have about 10, 12 minutes left. We're speaking this morning with Donald Johansson. He is a paleoanthropologist. He's the founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins in Berkeley, California. We have a couple of people here holding on who have questions, and we'll get back to the phones here, starting with line number one. Hello.
Good morning, David.
Uh-huh.
I would bet your guest probably believes in the Big Bang Theory as the start of the universe. Could he comment on that?
Well, as far as I know, we're only able to get back to about 10 to the minus 64 of the first second after the Big Bang, the cosmologists tell us. That's sort of outside of my purview, the Big Bang Theory, but apparently that does seem to be the case. I mean, I talked to somebody like Stephen Hawking or Timothy Ferris or Carl Sagan about that, but I have to sort of rely on those guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I would just comment that, you know, there were no scientists there at the creation of the universe.
That's for sure.
In fact, there weren't any around when these bones that you're talking about were live creatures. So I'm not sure what we can really say about that. They say that Mount St. Helens shows that formations of Earth are there that were formed very quickly after Mount St. Helens erupted that could possibly relate to other formations around the world where so-called evolutionists say that these happened over long periods of time when, in fact, they could have happened in very short periods of time.
Well, it's very interesting you bring up Mount St. Helens because there are structures that were created particularly by the volcanic ash which fell and the destruction of some of this that was caused by the eruptions, which are identical to some of the things that we find in the past that are dated to millions and millions of years. And I bring up, for example, the fact that at 3.5 million years, there is a site in northern Tanzania where there are human footprints in a volcanic ash. And we are often asked about how do we know that they're not a thousand years old or a couple of thousand years old. And in fact, if you take the volcanic ash from Mount St. Helens into a geological laboratory, such as one we have here at the Institute in Berkeley, and run it through our dating machine, the age of that volcanic ash comes out to be zero, because there is no argon gas in that volcanic ash. But if you take the volcanic ash where the footprints were found in eastern Africa and date it in the same machine, you come out with the date of 3.5 million years plus or minus, say, 25,000 years. So that what is interesting about observing eruptions like Mount St. Helens is that, as geologists have said for years, the present is really the key to the past. By looking at these events, they will help us interpret past events.
Does that get at your question, Carl?
Well, yeah, somewhat. Just a couple more brief comments. I would say, as one who does not believe in the theory of evolution, I would say
right there, you don't have to believe in it. I mean, do you believe in gravity? You don't have to believe in gravity. Knock off the family heirloom from the table and it falls to the ground. That's not a belief. That's a fact. Evolution is not a belief. Evolution is a fact. All we have to do is look around us. And it's happening every day. It has happened for millions of years. And it's not something you believe in. Religion is something you believe in.
Well, I think evolution is a religion, and it's a belief because you're starting with a given set of beliefs, and you're working up from there. So I would consider evolution a religion, just like I consider creationism a religion.
Well, thank heavens that all of those scientists who work in central Illinois, who develop Lester Pfister and DeKalb hybrids for corn and wheat and barley and so on, accept evolution, because if they didn't, the same thing would have happened in the United States that happened in the Soviet Union when Lysenko said, evolution isn't a fact, it's just a belief. And the Soviets have not been able to feed themselves because they have not embraced the idea of evolution and used it to enhance and make the world a better place for human beings to live in.
David, just one final comment.
Sure.
I know we're never going to agree with this, but obviously if you do believe in the evolutionary way of thinking, you absolutely throw out the Bible, and whether or not you believe in God or believe in the Bible, you are throwing out what the Bible says and what it stands for by believing those that profess the evolutionary way of thinking. I mean, it's as simple as that. Either you believe it or you don't believe it. You know, Christ said we're supposed to have a simple faith.
There was somebody named Jesus. I think there's no question about it. For the Bible, of course, was written by man. It was written by people, and it was written a long time ago before people knew about modern science.
We are growing short on time.
I
have to ask the caller to forgive me as well, because I do want to try to encourage to get some other people in here.
Sure.
And I think we've entered onto an area that we could discuss for a long time.
How are things in Urbana these days? You know, I was an undergraduate there.
Well, I I like the town very much. I think things are going along swimmingly. But see, you'll have to come back and see us again sometime soon. And see if
I would
soon.
Love to.
Let's go here to another caller. We'll go to line number four, our toll-free line. Hello.
I should like to ask about some of the recent challenges to the theory of evolution. You know that some impeccably qualified evolutionists don't quite have the faith that you have in evolution. For instance, Richard Lee, one time at Harvard, an impeccably qualified evolutionist, says that Darwinism, or Darwinists, he accuses them of telling just-so stories. And Stephen Jay Gould, your friend, came up with this new theory of punctuated equilibrium in response to the lack of transitional fossils in the fossil record.
Mm.
And so now, that is true, isn't it?
Now, what my friend Stephen Gould did was resurrect an idea that was, in fact, originally published by Charles Darwin in 1859 in his Origin of Species, in which Darwin said that under rapid environmental change, the speed of evolution will be much faster than under slower environmental change. He did not use the word punctuated equilibrium as Gould had done. It was resurrected again at the turn of the century by the saltationists, who said, well, evolution happens in spurts. It happens very rapidly. It doesn't happen gradually and slowly, as Darwin had said. And then, of course, the creationists have said, well, there are no transitional forms. And isn't it interesting that Lucy happens to be the one single transitional form that the creationists never wanted to have found? Because here is a virtually intermediate form with a head like an ape and a body like a human. And there are transitional forms in many other places, too. Now, what Gould has talked about specifically with punctuated equilibrium is the fact that in some areas of paleontology, you do have what appears to be very rapid transition from species A to species B. But that is often still debated by paleontologists, who say that you can still have gradual evolution if the evolution is happening outside of the particular area where the geological deposits are preserved. So that Steve Gould, Richard Lewontin, other colleagues of mine, we don't disagree on the fact that evolution occurred. We still have discussions about the details of how it occurs.
Well, now, if evolution occurs so rapidly, as you say, why hasn't someone demonstrated it in the laboratory?
Well, in the laboratory, they have, in fact. I published a book earlier this year called Blueprints, which is the genetic basis for evolutionary change. And in that book, we talk a lot about bacterial evolution and the fact that you have a species which can reproduce, you know, so quickly that you can have literally tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of generations over very short periods of time.
Right.
Those generations, those different populations sometimes become resistant to particular antibiotics because of mutations that occur.
Yeah, but that's selective breeding. That is every bacteria dying out.
That's what evolution is. You've said it exactly. Selective breeding.
There's no mutation there. That's every bacteria dying out, which is not resistant to the antibiotic.
That's right. And the ones that are resistant to it continue to live, and that's exactly what evolution is.
Yeah, but
in the case of the laboratory situation, or dogs, or the corn that grows right around where you live, people have invoked artificial selection. What we're talking about is natural selection in the environment,
where
you have environmental changes that occur that drive evolutionary change.
The theory, as I understand it, is that there's supposed to be a mutation, that evolution is dependent
upon... No, there doesn't have to be a mutation, because there is within any population a natural degree of variation. And what evolution does, what natural selection does, is it works on that naturally occurring range of variation, and it selects those individuals that are most fit to live in that environment. In fact, I like to say it is really the elimination of the unfit rather than the survival of the fittest. And in every population that occurs, we have a natural degree of variation. In human beings, for example, you know well, I'm sure, the case of sickle cell anemia. And in areas where there is malaria, a person who has one of those genes has a natural resistance to malaria, can survive, reproduce, and send his or her genes on to the next generation. That's, in fact, what evolution is.
Let me one final challenge you one final time, and I know the time is getting short, but if, as you say, what we're dealing with here is something that is within the established gene pool without any new genetic material being added. In other words, when a bacteria which is resistant to an antibiotic survives, no new genetic material has been mutated. All that is there is what was present in the original gene pool of that species. How can you call that evolution?
Well, we can't get into, obviously, genetic recombination at this point. But if you have a chance to look at blueprints, it does explain that particular issue.
I'm afraid I'm just going to have to stop, and my apologies. I have a couple of people we can't take. It is a fascinating topic. I'm sure we could continue to talk for a long time. However, we have come to the end of the time. Professor Johansson, thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate your time.
Nice to talk with you.
Bye-bye. Donald Johansson is the founder and director of the Institute of Human Origins in Berkeley, California. If you were interested in reading more of his work, you might look at the book Lucy's Child, The Discovery of a Human Ancestor. It is published by William Morrill and Company.